Why don't we get into it?
Yeah, sure.
You've been practicing medicine for many years. Can you go back to that time when you thought about, wow, this would be a nice profession to get into? And maybe tell us a bit about why you chose the specialty you did.
Well, let me see if I can remember that far back. I mean, I entered medical school 42 years ago, and really, when I was growing up, there was never any other choice kind of presented to me, really. I was, I think, manifesting my mother's sort of frustration that she'd always wanted to be a doctor, and she ended up being a musician. She loved science when she was small, but girls didn't do science. And so, as early as I could remember, I heard this idea that if you're given a good brain, the only thing worthy is doing something that helps other people. And if you've got a good brain, then that means you can be a doctor, right? So that was kind of the idea that was, it slotted home at an early age. And I never really thought about it until it was too late. And then I somehow got a place in medical school, second time round anyway. I did my best, I think, not to get one, but I did in the end. And all my friends were going off to music college, actually, because I played in youth orchestras and things. And I decided, actually, I'd much rather be a orchestral musician playing the trombone. But it was far too late, and I'd never done the work, and I got this place. So I thought, well, I can use it as a ticket to travel. So I had the best 5 years studying, and the next couple of years out were great. And then I started traveling with it. You could, at that stage, you could transplant your degree to a number of countries. It's much more difficult now. So I got around the place, experienced different jurisdictions, and tried a few things. I ended up back in the UK after a few years traveling the world and working in Australia and coming here, actually. And I did anesthetics for a few years, and I thought that that was my thing. So I came out to New Zealand to finish off my training in 1994, and got caught in the middle of a sort of political spat between the Australasian colleges and the UK college. And it was my first sort of experience of, I guess, how medical politics could suddenly and completely, decapitate your career plans. And I was told that I could stay in New Zealand, but I'd have to go right back to square one of the training program in anesthetics and intensive care. And I thought, well, how badly do I want to do this? I was enjoying the chemistry and the immediacy of anesthetics. It was, challenging in some ways, but I sort of got to think, well, how much do I want to spend the rest of my life in a single room, often underground without daylight, with only surgeons to talk to? And I thought, well, I'll give something else a go. So I'd done my general practice training originally, before I left the UK, and I knew that I didn't want to be a GP in the UK, the way things were structured back then. So I went back to primary care and general practice here in New Zealand, and actually really enjoyed it, because it was office hours, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. You could do some after-hours work if you wanted, but the after-hours care was well set up, and I found I could have a life. So I started playing my trombone again and got some professional work. And then moved to another town where I got a job in the orchestra, which was only part-time, but I could do my medicine as well. So during this time, I was working in lots and lots of different practices, lots of practices in primary care and general practice. And it seemed to me that we were just presiding over a gradual decrepitude, really, using different drugs for different symptoms. And I kind of felt it just lacked something, and I just assumed it was, just me, and that, I was no good at it. In my hands, it wasn't something that had any power. And then I sort of fell into learning about clinical nutrition, and all the light bells went on. The lights went on, sorry, and the bells went off. A lot of things that never made sense to me in medicine started to fall into place. And it reminded me too that from my anesthetic days, learning lots of chemistry, that it's, so much of life is all about the chemistry of life, biochemistry, and about biomolecules, and what happens if you don't get the ones you need, or you get them in the wrong balance, or you get, things that the body was never designed for. And it dawned on me that so much of ill health is essentially the body's attempts to just keep going as best it can, you know, with the hand that we that it plays based on how we choose to live, and that many symptoms and disease processes are kind of compensatory mechanisms where the body's trying to adapt. But more than that, it's triaging. It's selectively withholding certain key things where there isn't enough from systems, or so it seemed to me, that were less essential for life, so that the essential systems could keep going. And then I ended up doing a fellowship in environmental medicine and clinical nutrition, and then did quite a lot of teaching for 10 years or so at the postgraduate level. We trained mostly other doctors in clinical nutrition. And as part of that, you know, you mug up your lectures, you know, you do your research. You know, as you know, Dan, you know, you basically got to sound you've got to be convinced by your own material before you can, you know, teach other people. And that just kept affirming for me how much more to medicine there was and there still is, and how much a better practitioner you can be when you have these other ways of approaching or thinking about health issues. So part of that journey of discovery was also about, you know, freeing oneself from the kind of umbilical cord to pharmaceutical medicine, and recognizing that yes, you know, there are some incredibly powerful drugs that can be life-saving, and you know, we're very grateful for them. But the vast majority of pills that we certainly were using in general practice were a kind of a sticking plaster. You know, there's a warning light on the dashboard. And you can either stop the car and open the bonnet and see what needs to be changed, you know, what's the cause of it, or you can put a sticking plaster over the warning light so you don't see it anymore. And many of our pills did exactly that. And so much of the teaching in the early days was not about the causes of illness. There was just this assumption that the body goes wrong, you know, and there's nothing you can do about it, or you don't need to go there or bother about why it happens because you can't fix it anyway, or, you know, it's genetic somehow. And then you just, you know, do your best to keep the patient happy. But, you know, every single drug that you prescribe, you know, the effect that you want is actually a side effect, because they're all designed to interfere with something the body does. You know, you're intervening in biochemical pathways. All right, so a symptom gets better, but almost inevitably something else will go wrong. You know, because that same pathway will be found in other systems or in other cells, or there'll be upstream or downstream consequences of you, you know, messing around with the chemistry. And that's where side effects come from. So I developed a really much improved respect for the, you know, the potential harm that medications can do.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some of the things you said reminded me of the importance of stasis and trying to achieve balance in life, whether it's, you know, social balance with other human beings, or really a balance within our own bodies, where so many hidden processes are at work. And I really like the point that you made. I don't think it's made enough, because we live in the world of presuppositions about the power of a pill or an injection to rid the body of all of these diseases and so forth, that a magic pill or an injection will be the cure to everything. And it seems to be not the case. The more that we look at how our environment affects our psychological states, our emotional states, spiritual and physical states. So when did you begin to smell a rat as the narrative started to unfold in late 2019? Was there a point at which you thought, something doesn't seem right here?
Yeah, well, I guess I've been a bit of a skeptic from way back. And one of the few advantages of getting old, I guess, is that you've seen a lot of stuff before. And I mean, I've worked through year after year after year. Well, I've worked through 37 winters in my professional life, and you see influenzas, you see whichever the, you know, the virus du jour of that particular winter is. And you know, you recognize that, you know, one of the sort of natural causes of death, if you like, is people who pass on after failing to fight a bug that the previous year, you know, they'd have fought off successfully as the immune system ages as well. So we're used to all that. And I distinctly paid attention during the swine flu that the world had, the pandemic in 2008, I think it was. And I remember that the European Commission was very critical of the WHO and the pharmaceutical industry for A, beating up the severity of the swine flu illness itself, and B, you know, rushing in a vaccine and strongly promoting that as necessary. You know, and I can remember the day that swine flu started in our country, in New Zealand. It was a Monday morning, and I turned up, and 11 out of 12 of the patients I saw in the morning all had influenza symptoms. But you know what? They were all in the waiting room. You know, and in really bad influenza, you know, you go and visit people in their own homes, they can't get out of bed. So it seemed to me that it was a relatively mild clinical illness. It was still no fun. But you know, and I think about 30% of our population had it by the end of the, you know, by the end of that winter. So it went through fairly quickly, about 6-8 weeks, and it was all gone, as happens if you leave these things to come and go. So a lot of people got it. It was more transmissible than your typical influenza, but it wasn't as severe. But there was this report done, and you know, that really got my attention, because already at that stage I was, you know, interested in non-drug approaches to health, and some of the stuff I was reading around, you know, the marketing practices in the pharmaceutical industry and just their history of their behavior and some of the fines. You know, there was almost a sense that it's just, you know, normal business to every now and then get called out and pay a giant fine and kind of carry on. So, you know, that made an impression on me. And then I spent the next 10 years running my own practice. I'm working very hard actually to combine general practice, standard general practice care with a sort of functional medicine, integrative medicine approach. So 2019, you know, we heard these stories, and look, you know, I was as scared as the best of them. You know, I saw this footage coming out of Wuhan, and we were told, look, it might be a 3 or 4% fatality rate you need to get yourselves ready for. And that seemed like, you know, serious stuff. So, you know, we had this lockdown here, and I was actually initially supportive, because it seemed to me that you know, this may well be a disastrous freight train, and we needed to buy ourselves time. We seem to have kept it out. We needed to watch and figure out what was going on. But very quickly, the actual fatality rate, you know, came in. Both the WHO and John Ioannidis published, look, you know, it's looking around about, well, I think initially 0.4%, and then it was dropped down to 0.15. So, you know, most people were absolutely fine. And it was very clear, too, that it was the elderly and the unwell elderly that seemed to be the really high-risk group. But it wasn't people with COPD, you know, with chronic chest disease, as you might expect. It was actually people with obesity, type 2 diabetes, ischemic heart disease, renal disease. So people with established vascular disease. And also people with a history of anxiety and depression, that kind of stuck out to me as well fairly quickly. They seem to be a high-risk group on their own. So I certainly felt much more relaxed about, you know, not personally succumbing to it, and my family and friends. This seemed to be just a flu in that sense. And then there was talk of, you know, some early treatments that seemed to be helpful for people at risk. And you know, some of the names, Zelenko and Peter McCullough and the you know, frontline critical care guys, you know, they were all releasing their protocols and saying they were seeing really good effects with hydroxychloroquine. And then in a heartbeat, it was taken off the shelves here. So GPs could no longer prescribe hydroxychloroquine. And we've been using it for, you know, well, it's decades old. It's been used for malaria prophylaxis and in inflammatory disorders. And in fact, I didn't even really know it was a thing until it was removed. And then I went and had a look and found that all these people were publishing protocols. And then Artemisia was removed from the shelves as well. And as an integrative doctor, that really piqued me off, because Artemisia is a, you know, very helpful herb. You know, it's used in complementary cancer therapies. And that was taken away as well. And the justification that was given by the drug industry representatives here was that it wasn't fair that it should be on the shelves, because all of their drugs costed billions of dollars to get through the, you know, the experimental stages and then to be finally approved. And it just wasn't fair that Artemisia could be sold for COVID. So that was taken off the shelves. And then, of course, the fraudulent trials around hydroxychloroquine came out, which was the second biggest story, I think, of 2020, actually, that nobody heard, which was, you know, two top medical journals, the Lancet and I think JAMA, was it, or New England Journal, both got suckered by this study that supposedly was the last word on HCQ being dangerous and ineffective. And so as a result of that, a whole bunch of other trials that were in progress for hydroxychloroquine got stopped. And then within a few weeks, some of the hospitals that had submitted the data to the researchers said, this isn't the data that we submitted. You know, what are you doing? And then it became clear the whole thing was a fraud. So there were retractions issued. But this was a massive story. But it wasn't really covered in the mainstream media. And people didn't change their perspective or their view on early treatments. You know, doctors were already being lectured at that stage that there's nothing in them. You know, everything will be about the vaccine. You know, and that was the other thing that got my attention very early on, was the discussion around the vaccine. And I remember thinking, yeah, yada, yada, there might be a vaccine in the end, but it'll be, you know, 3 or 4 years away. So in the meantime, you know, we just better get on treating this illness or figuring out how to treat it. And then as 2020 went on, it became clear that actually there was a clinical trial and you know, then it was given sort of emergency use authorization in the States, and they were starting to use it, and it was used in the UK, and then they talked about it coming here. And it was very surprising that from, you know, nothing to having a product in less than a year. And not only that, we were told it's a brand new platform. So, you know, well, what, this won't end well, you know, this quickly and this rushed out, you know, 2 months of human data. And then the impossibly optimistic 95%, you know, abolition of COVID that seems so exciting that nobody stopped to think, well, hang on, what are they actually saying here? 95% of what? You know, is it so are people not going to give it to each other? Are they not going to get sick? And as we know, you know, the real world, the absolute risk reduction was 0.84% based on that particular trial. So they extrapolated this trial, which is, you know, clinical trial evidence 101, you don't do that. But it was marketed all around the world as being, you know, the salvation, we'll all get our lives back if we just take this jab. So we didn't introduce it first here, but in around about Easter, when it was coming, and in fact, we received our consent forms. The medical profession was sent consent forms as being sort of in the first wave of people as you know, frontline health workers who needed to be protected. And I've never seen such, you know, a pathetic excuse for a consent form in my life. You know, it was, you know, written by the marketing department of Pfizer, it seemed to me, you know, and quite a lot of us agree. So people like myself who were already, you know, say less, you know, just more open to the downsides of all this, you know, found each other fairly quickly. We wrote a letter to our drug regulators and our colleges and the Ministry of Health, just asking questions about some of the things we were told and how it was that the safe and effective narrative that was already being pushed could possibly be have any substance behind it, given how little time and little data. And we'd already figured out that there were no animal trials and the animal trials that had been done previously for coronavirus vaccines all ended badly. And there were question mark, you know, there was no safety in pregnancy done. There was no, you know, looking at what's called teratogenesis, so interfering with you know, the development of fetuses, cancer, you know, immune dysfunction, none of that stuff. There was no data at all, and yet we were supposed to parrot this line, this propaganda. And it just seemed to us to be entirely guesswork and hopelessly optimistic. But not only were we supposed to parrot it, but we were threatened with our licenses if we disagreed in any way with that narrative. We were expected to be injected ourselves, and You know, we were expected to promote the benefits, and any, you know, anti-vaccine statements would risk our licenses. And then it's been a slow motion train wreck really since then of a sort of dismantlement of the ethical basis of medicine. You know, we've been saying for over a year that there's been a coup against conscientious medicine. The basic bedrock sort of ethical foundations that are thousands of years in the making, you know, in terms of the thought that's gone into them and the testing, you know, do no harm. The first thing you have to think with any treatment is what might be the downsides and is it strictly necessary? And to give all the information that there is, including the information that there isn't, so people know, you know, what's known and what isn't. And they can make their choice, which has to always include them choosing not to take a treatment. I mean, you can't get more fundamental than that.
That's right. Speaking of what's known and what isn't known as regards informed consent, you belong to a big international interdisciplinary research cohort. I'm kind of wondering, how does your own work, how does it square with what's being shared in the cohort? Are you finding what in these discussions, are you finding things that are similar to what is shared in the cohort?
Yes, I am, but it gives me the chance to say that I'm not actually working at the moment. So I'm going through a disciplinary process. I was suspended by my medical counsel. In fact, I'm probably the only doctor in New Zealand that's been suspended twice in succession. So I won in court. I won the right to be reinstated and have my medical license back, actually with no conditions placed on it. And my medical counsel immediately resuspended me. And they knew that my medical certificate to practice would lapse fairly shortly afterwards and that I'd have significant hurdles getting it back. Which is correct. And at this stage, I've chosen not to reapply. So I'm not treating patients. And I can call myself a doctor because I have a doctorate in medicine. But, you know, my views are, of course, different to the government's and probably not shared by the majority of doctors in my country. But there's a sizable minority of doctors for sure that share my concerns. You know, and I've arrived at my views based on thousands and thousands of hours anyway, over a thousand of study into every aspect. And that includes, with some colleagues, looking at, you know, vaccine down the microscope. Now I'm not a trained medical scientist, but, you know, I'm very well aware of the, you know, the literature that already existed around, you know, what contaminants historically have been found in vaccines, what they look like, what vaccines ought to look like. And of course, that's to remember that what we're dealing with now is not the same anyway as the vaccines that we're used to. It's not a vaccine in definition. You know, it does not produce immunity. It does not stop you passing on the infection to other people. That was clear from the outset. And it's very obvious now. So the definition of, you know, the vaccine was changed, but also the way that this product is made makes it very different. But we, you know, the work that the group that we're part of is doing is, if it's telling us nothing else, there is a huge variability, it seems, in what is found in these vaccines, and certainly the structures that appeared. And the other groups in our country too, who've used different microscopy techniques, and actually do have experience and credibility as laboratory scientists, and who know what should and shouldn't be, you know, seen down the microscope. You know, we all agree that there's easily a case. You know, we've long passed the threshold for an investigation and stopping the rollout, and we've passed on the information that we've got to our regulators, who took no notice. So in fact, we passed it on to the police as well. I mean, this has happened in other countries as well, and there's a sort of tried and well-trodden pathway that involves everybody basically taking no notice. And I must say that when I referred to the letter that we wrote to all the regulators early on, sort of in Easter 2020, we were greeted with absolute silence. No one responded to our questions and concerns, every one of which, I think, to my satisfaction, has been proven, absolutely correct, as a thing to worry about. So we knew straight away that this was much, much bigger than perhaps we thought, and that we were all in big trouble, because these were reasonable questions, but something sinister and fundamental had changed in our ability to communicate with our regulators and with our colleagues, even.
It is astonishing, isn't it? You think about, it seems as though the entire world is in this grip of a sort of pharmaceutical hegemony. What can we do?
Yeah, well, if it was just that, if that was all we had to worry about, I guess, maybe we'd have some cause for a bit more optimism. But it seems, not only are we fighting this, but we're fighting, wars for every pillar of our survival. In this country, the water's being taken out of the hands of the people. There's a war on food. Farmers are really on the back foot. All of it couched in terms of, carbon emissions, the sort of mythical, bogeyman that's going to do us all in. There's our money, our fuel. New Zealand is critically reliant now on tankers. We had a perfectly good oil refinery, and we make good oil, but most of it gets shipped overseas. The light sweet crude has always been exported, and the heavy sour stuff we've refined for ourselves. But the government closed that refinery, and not only that, they spiked it. They poured concrete into the pipes so that nobody else can use it, or we can't easily get it going again. So this is treasonous to me. We seem to be cutting ourselves off at the knees, and our economies, suffering the same, potential for a complete collapse that most of the Western world seems to be suffering. Our health systems in disarray. Many of the people who work in it are off sick, and in fact getting recurring sicknesses. So we're going into our summer, and yet we've never been busier in terms of people being admitted with infectious disease, and we have the same issue with unexplained deaths in younger people. Well, in fact, in all age groups, but it's particularly noticeable and particularly tragic, I suppose, in children, teenagers, young adults, working age people, that is not due to COVID, and in common with all these other vaccinated countries that are. Releasing the same statistics, it's not being investigated either. And we've just had some proposals here to further water down the Coroner's Act, so that it'll be even less likely that there'll be inquests and postmortems in these often, young, healthy people who shockingly, suddenly die. And again, when you've been a doctor for as long as I have, you know that very occasionally, very rarely, young people will suddenly die of something other than suicide or violence or an accident or the occasional, rare cancer. But sudden, out of the blue, waking up dead, as we say somewhat sardonically in medicine, it just doesn't happen. And yet it's happening dreadfully often around the world. And the power of the internet allows us to see these dreadful montages of people literally suddenly dying, often on camera, and sports people, and that interests me because, the science now is starting to be able to explain why it is that, sudden death as a manifestation of inflammatory changes in the blood vessels in the heart, will cause a sudden cardiac arrest.
I guess
the science has been teased out, but you know, try telling the governments that.
Yeah. We had to invent new euphemisms for the condition, right? Sudden adult death syndrome. Yeah, it seems like a global controlled demolition of everything human.
It does seem like that, doesn't it? Who would have thought in our lifetimes? But, you know, I've often thought in my lifetime, Dan, you know, I was sort of a reluctant secondhand student, I suppose, of the 20th century, because my mum was always reading, you know, history books, history of the 20th century, European history. She remembers standing at the bottom of her garden as a six-year-old, seeing the sort of the orange glow of her neighboring kind of naval port on fire after the Germans bombed it. You know, and she talked a lot in her life about these recurring cycles of you know, war and tyranny and it being baked in the cake of human nature. She was always very pessimistic, actually, about ultimately the outlook for humans, and that really we should have left the planet to animals a long time ago. But you know, she was absolutely right. And you know, you've only got to look at the history of the 20th century to see how quickly leaders will you know, take the power they're given, maybe at the ballot box, but then just go rogue with it. And it seems like we've taken our eye off the ball again. You know, so actually, here we are. I'm lucky enough in my life to be experiencing a similar, you know, aspect of human nature that sees us staring down the barrel of a gun, it would seem. And yet it hasn't happened yet. And there are lots of people who know something's wrong. And it's trying to help people connect the dots and show them how wrong it is so that they find the imperative to, you know, to act. But it's that human nature thing, you know, fight or flight or freeze. And I think even a lot of awake people, you know, just don't want to believe what might be happening. And I'd say, well, you know, can we take a risk that it's not actually happening and ignore it and wait and see? Well, that's not how, you know, I want to try and plan for my family's future. You know, so we have to know. And I think we're learning a lot. We are learning a lot. And groups around the world are all finding the same thing. And look, even if we don't know exactly, you know, why this stuff is in the vaccine, we know it's there. We know it shouldn't be. It's not for us to know exactly what it is. You know, there are people that are paid and elected to, you know, respond to our concerns, but, you know, many of them seem lost at sea. There's a few, you know, chinks of light coming through, I think. We have to say that to stay sane and optimistic.
That's right. Thank you so much for the talk.
It's been a pleasure.